I included in the email last week, in the follow-up email, the flyer for our June mini-series, a two-parter in June. Topic is, when will Mashiach come? It should be a very interesting and fun discussion, I think, I hope. It's going to have an in-person option at Yeshivat Or Chaim, the place where, you'll recall, we have learned in June's past. There's no fee, as we've done with the June series in the past as well. When you register, you will have the choice of selecting either in-person or Zoom or unsure. Check one of the boxes. Hopefully people will be in-person. I'm really rooting for that.
Can you remind them then to have the back door open so that...
Yeah, no, we're going to have to take care of all of those things. Yes, all of that is going to have to be dealt with. And I'm sure because we're out of practice, we haven't done it in a couple of years, something where we'll figure out we missed something, but we're going to try to hit all the buttons, the unlock, the AC, the whole bit, the washroom being unlocked, everything. That's number one. Number two, I'm happy to share some very good news I got this morning. Ronit, who was in our office, gave birth to a healthy baby boy. Thank God. So I just got the news this morning. I don't know when the bris is, but yes, that's a good piece of news, and that's why you email Aya when you want to register for things as opposed to Ronit. Okay. So let's get started here on our conclusion of Magilei Tzedek, Circles of Justice. We finished the story last week, and we started discussing the layers of the story, and that's what I want to complete this week. So our first layer, which we talked about, was the old man, the anonymity of the old man as an everyman and a Job specifically. Somebody who suffers terribly, remains loyal to his vision. That's sort of the first piece of it. And we talked about the rejection he experiences and connected that with a Talmudic passage. But there's a lot more to say here. So first of all, this is a satire of human justice, right? The story could be called Circles of Justice, but it's really Circles of Injustice. And I think this is fairly self-evident, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this layer. When I taught this story a few years ago for the Avnon group, someone asked me whether I knew anything about the influence of the Dreyfus trial on Avnon. He certainly was aware of it, but I have not been able to find anything in his writing that references it. I do feel like that was a story which would build up people's lack of faith in human justice, that's for sure. But in general, Agnon is an iconoclast. He does not trust political institutions. He's something of a cynic about such things, and he wrote about that explicitly and implicitly in a range of stories, so it's not surprising to see this here. He calls the story Circles of Justice, and the circles in this story are literal. Professor Arela Abramson, who I've quoted elsewhere, notes that the old man in our story lives in circles and cycles. So, for example, within the story itself, and I posted the link in the chat for both the source sheet and the translation, within the story, we get three repetitions of 5 days per week, right, where it talks about his routine. It tells us, if you wanted to check it inside, towards the beginning of the story, for the first 5 days of the week, he would engage in his trade, and on Fridays, he would fill up a large can and make his rounds. And then a couple of sentences later, he says, 5 days a week, I make vinegar to sell. When I have sold it, I make some more and go out again to sell it. And then later on in the story, on page 194, 5 days a week, he made vinegar, and on Fridays, he would fill up the can. It's this expression of repetition, which when we were reading it out loud, I was sort of emphasizing, hoping that people would catch that. Remember how it described him splitting his funds, the 50-50 split? That shows up in this story four times. Four times it tells us with the same language. So that on, if you're looking at page 193, half of which he would take for sustenance, the other half he would put into a charity box. And then further down the page, one half for his immediate requirements, one half for his traveling expenses. Further down the page, one half for his sustenance, one half for the charity box. And then again, on the bottom of 194, he would apportion the money he had made, one half for his immediate requirements, the other for his traveling expenses, over and over and over again. Three different times we get in Hebrew, betoch kach avru or yatzu kama shanim, that in this process much time went by. So it says on page 193, and thus several years passed. And then a few sentences later, and thus several years passed. And then again on page 195, and thus several years passed. Over and over and over again, his whole life is a loop of futility. That's really what you're seeing here. And I couldn't help remembering, and I brought it for you in source number one, the verse in Job, another Job reference here, in which Job grieves after he has lost his children and he has lost his wealth, and he says, and Job rose and tore his clothing and plucked hair from his head and fell to the ground and bowed, and he said, unclothed I emerged from my mother's womb, and unclothed I will return there. God has given and God has taken. May God's name be blessed. Right? It's a cycle. He turns all of life into a cycle. I started with nothing. I end with nothing. God gives, God takes away. It's all a cyclical experience, and he can't break out of it. The best evidence that he can't break out of it is, of course, the way that it emphasizes that he keeps on doing what he's doing, and he can't bring himself to stop. He has all this money saved up, and he can't bring himself to actually collect it and go until the vat that he's filling, this can, breaks, and then he's going to go. So he's a man who lives in unending circles and cycles. And then the other part of the title is that these are supposed to be circles of justice, but they are unjust. And here I refer you to a verse I already quoted in an earlier session in source number two, the verse from Psalms, Yancheni v'magilei tzedek. We express the wish for God to lead us in circles of justice. That's the aspiration. We want circles of justice, but in fact, in this story, it's circles of injustice. He's not getting to those circles of justice that he longs for. Instead, it is circles of injustice. And we already connected this. I'll take the question in a second. We connected this also to the label of the old man as vinegar, son of wine, and the story that we read with Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, who made an alliance with the Romans to arrest Jewish criminals, and he was accused of being unjust, even though in his perception of events, he was doing something that was just. This cynicism about human justice, this feeling of we just go around and around in circles and things are corrupt, is a very Jewish thing. Even though Judaism is, I always maintain, an optimistic religion, nonetheless, the book of Kohelet of Ecclesiastes, while a standout book, reflects a current of skepticism at least. If you take a look at source number three, the verse from Ecclesiastes, the speaker, King Solomon, says, I have also seen beneath the sun, in the place of judgment there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is the wicked. The place where there is supposed to be mishpat, where there is supposed to be justice, shama haresha, there we have wickedness. That's what Agnon is expressing here in this story about aspirations for justice that lead nowhere. Okay, I heard somebody unmute. They wanted to ask a question or make a comment? I thought? No? Okay. Then we go further. We have layer upon layer to go, so no shortage of things to say this morning. As a religious text, this story is an ode to the simple Jew. Remember that Agnon is very, very familiar with and writes a lot about the battles between the Hasidim on the one hand and the Misnagdim on the other. I taught a story for the Agnon group a little while ago. It was in a two-parter called Hanidach. Hanidach, the banished one, the rejected one. A really sad story about a young man who grows up in a community that is anti-Hasidic, and that's really the word for it when you read the story, and he is drawn to the Hasidim, and it does not end well. And I gave you links on the source sheet in source number 4 for anyone who wants to download the recording. But the story goes back to the basic split, which we're not going to discuss at length right now, but remember that in the period in the middle of the 18th century to the latter part of the 18th century, when you have the growth of the Hasidim position themselves as believers in drawing close to God. You don't need great scholarship. You do not need to be part of some elite. The point is just feel close to God. However, you know, perfect you are in your observance and your knowledge, just draw close to God and try to fulfill as much ritual as you can. Now, Hasidim are different groups and there are different sects within it and they have different philosophies. Some of them are more into Torah study. Some of them emphasize it less. Some of them seem to be happier. Some of them have less of a focus on joy. I'm not trying to homogenize Hasidim. But that's sort of one camp. And the Misnagdim, on the other hand, who did not name themselves Misnagdim. Misnagdim means the opposition. That's a term that the Hasidim, in a brilliant act of marketing, succeeded in doing. We're the Hasidim and they're the opponents, even though the others were the mainstream. The Misnagdim believed very much in excellence in Torah study, and they really looked down on those early Hasidim. That's very dramatically presented in that story of Hanidach. So if you were to pick sort of the simple Jew who isn't so educated but feels he's close to Judaism or close to God, his home would be much more with the Hasidim than it would be with the Misnagdim. That's the idea here. And those battles between the groups, which became physical battles at times, come up in Agnon's writing. Agnon's father's family were Hasidim, his mother's family were Misnagdim, and he lived in the town of Buchach, that's where he came from, in the Ukraine, which was a hotbed for strife between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim long before Agnon's time. You know, this is something which people have a hard time grasping in our day, because today, like, you know, people who are observant are observant, people who are not observant, it's like the battles between Hasidim and Misnagdim are not as visible, thank God, in our day. I remember when I was a kid, in the 70s and 80s, there were certain things that went on in Brooklyn between Hasidic groups. But I'll tell you the story which is attributed to the Satmar Rebbe, whether it's really his story or not. I may have told it in some context before. He wanted to explain, this is middle 20th century, he wanted to explain how it is that we don't see Hasidim and Misnagdim fighting it out anymore. It hasn't, it's no longer a dispute. He said, imagine that you have a father and a daughter. The mother passed away. You have a father and a daughter who live in the same house. And the father loves to eat meat. So the daughter always cooks fleishik for him. She cooks meat. However, one day, she meets a nice young man. And the nice young man loves to eat dairy. And they get married and move in to the house. So the young woman, I apologize for the feminists in the group, but the young woman is now cooking for her father and she's cooking for her husband. So the father eats meat in one room and the husband eats dairy in another room because meat and dairy aren't going to mix. However, over time, the family becomes a little bit indigent. They have less money than they used to have and they can't afford meat anymore. Nonetheless, the father continues to eat parev in his room, and the husband eats dairy in his room. And over time, they have a little less money, and they can't afford dairy anymore either. And yet, the father eats parav in his room, and the husband eats parav in his room. And he said, that's what the Hasidim and Misnagdim are like. The Hasidim are no longer Hasidim. The Misnagdim are no longer Misnagdim. But they still eat in their separate rooms, and they still identify as separate groups. In any case, there's a lot to be said about that story. But I wanted to show you a little bit of Agnon's experience of, and sort of what informed his outlook on the strife between Hasidim and Misnagdim. Take a look, please, at source number 5. This is from a memorial book about the Buchach community. Buchach was characterized by people like Rabbi Avram David ben Asher. This was a great Torah scholar who lived there. His life history and philosophy constitute a very important chapter in Buchach's history. We shall, however, suffice with a concise account of his story. As a boy, he already drew attention to himself by his great Talmudic erudition and sharpness. Tzvi Hirsch, author of Netash HaAshuim, chose him as a son-in-law for his daughter. I hope his daughter also chose. All right. At 20, he was ready to serve as the rabbi of Yazlovich. Buchach was a town of scholars and Talmudists who did not believe in the tzaddikim and their miracles. Tzaddikim is the term for the leader of a Hasidic movement. They are believed to have a greater soul than the others, and they're connected to God. That term tzaddik gives way ultimately to the term rebbe, but that's what we're talking about. So the Misnagdim do not believe in these tzaddikim and their miracles. The war between the Talmudists and the Hasidim reached its peak at that time, and it greatly troubled Rabbi Avram. When his son fell ill, his wife and friends urged him to bring the sick child to Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, a famous Hasidic Rebbe. After refusing for a long while, he finally consented. From that day on, he was a different man. He was greatly influenced by Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, who helped him in reconciling his Talmudic and Hasidic views, positions that were polarized in his town. The Hasidim could not imagine a greater joy, for many of them feared his mastery of the Talmud and rabbinical law. They said, if he's on the opposition, we're in trouble. Now he's on our team. Nevertheless, after he inherited his father-in-law's position, everyone marveled at his religious knowledge, but opposed his way of life, his following the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, considered the founder of modern Hasidus. In the practice of rabbinical law, he would draw his judgment from the Talmud and from rabbinical authorities, not from the Kabbalah, from mysticism. He was very solidly mainstream. His wide-ranging literary work was basically rationalistic, Talmudic, exegetic. His essay Dag Kedoshim, as well as Eshel Avram, was incorporated as an independent section of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law. This is true. I first encountered this rabbi we're describing, Rabbi Avram David, son of Asher. I first learned about him when I learned his writing on the Code of Jewish Law. That's how he was known. In addition to all of his other books, he wrote a Kabbalistic commentary named Birkat David, David's Blessing. At one point in his life, his reason was somewhat shaken, and according to tradition, he was cured by the rabbi of Sasov. He acted as Buchach's rabbi till the day he died, approximately 50 years, and bestowed his spirit upon the town. So here you have someone who was a local product, who was a prodigy Talmudically in a way that the Misnagdim would have been very proud, and he came over to some Hasidic ideas as well. You follow the story? This is a real person. This is not an Agnon story. But now look at source number 6. The following story from the book Dorot HaChadash. This is supposed to be a true story. It once happened with the great and holy Rabbi Avram David of Buchach, author of Birkat David, his Kabbalistic work, that he went to the outhouse, and one of his opponents locked him in the outhouse for about an hour. The righteous and holy sage was very upset because of the fumes and because he needed to narrow his holy thoughts, for he never ceased thinking holy thoughts, cleaving to the creator of all, meaning he was always thinking about God and now he couldn't because he's in the latrine. So he was very upset and very angry. And when his household realized and opened the door for him, they said he should avenge himself against his enemies and issue a ban against them for the honor of heaven and Torah. He almost listened to their counsel. He took a shofar to trumpet the ban. That's part of the ritual. But then the Holy One said to himself, tell me, are you truly and completely concerned for the honor of God's name and his Torah? Perhaps you're concerned for your own honor. How will you know the truth? In a moment, the Holy One became someone else and refrained. He overcame that desire. And for those who learned the story of Hanidach, this becomes the founding story for Hanidach, in which Agnon describes a Hasidish Rebbe who undergoes a terrible indignity, and he is going to issue such a ban, and he stops and thinks, maybe it's only for my own honor, and then he does it. He issues the ban with terrible results. So this is what's in Agnon's mindset as he's writing. He's thinking about the struggle between the classic Talmudists, the Misnagdim on the one hand, and the Hasidim on the other hand. And Agnon, and my read of his writing, sides with the Hasidim. He likes the simple Jew. He makes the simple Jew a hero. And you see it in our story. Over and over again in the story, he emphasized this is a simple man, right? I don't remember the exact lines anymore. I didn't look them up beforehand. But he talks about how a simple person just does what he does and he never deviates from it. He talked about how because he's simple, he doesn't understand the purpose of this box in which he's putting his money. He doesn't understand that it's from the church. When he's in the jail and when he's on trial, he can't understand why it is that they're not listening to him and not freeing him. Hey, it's my money. He's a simple person. That's all he is. And he's not somebody who engages in ritual and practice. Remember, he doesn't like his talis and his tefillin. He doesn't pronounce the words properly. We read that. He read the prayers, but he didn't pronounce the letters properly. That was emphasized. He doesn't study any Torah, which is the hallmark of the Misnagdim for Agnon. And yet, by the end of the story, he has achieved holiness. Right? He's sitting in the jail and he takes the position of Yordei Merkava, the people who engage in study of God's divine throne. He puts his head between his knees, and we talked about last time how that's an act of piety associated with various examples from the Talmud, and God takes care of him. So that what Agnon is doing here, one layer of this story, is to lionize the simple Jew. And saying he may be simple and he does things that you laugh at and you look at and say, what in the world are you doing? You're saving your money for Aliyah by putting it in a box with the statue of that man? Like, what are you thinking? But he wins, so to speak. Religiously, he wins. And I brought you source number 7 as the ultimate source for this, a passage in the Talmud in which the sage Rava complained about the fact that God did not listen when he prayed for rain. And he said, I don't understand. Rav Yehuda, one of the sages, removes his shoes and rain comes. All he has to do is take off his shoes as part of beginning his appeal to God. He's not Canadian. It's not like going into the house. He removes his shoes as an act of grief. And automatically, the rain comes. We cry out and no one pays attention to us. Why? Because God desires the heart. It's not about how great we are as scholars. That's the part that I skipped in this Talmudic passage, is where he talks about all their scholarship. He says, God desires the heart. As it says, God sees the heart. That's a biblical verse, the Aramaic, Rachmana Liba Boi, God wants the heart. And that's what you're seeing here in this story. Yes, question, Susan.
Yeah, I'm troubled. I found the story very difficult to read as we kept going on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is the hero, and more than just the main character, but the hero of a story, the suffering that he goes through, what I don't want to understand is why does he have to suffer to reach holiness? I know about the Job story, I learned it with you, but he's made the suffering this man didn't need. This man didn't enjoy life. This man lived a horrible life till the very end. And is suffering supposed to be part of attaining this? I mean, why, if this is what he admires, he took this man to a very low level of a life.
Right. So my answer is, and I hear what you're saying, Agnon is not prescribing. Agnon is describing. This is what he has observed. You know, someone commented to me the other night, we're reading something from Rabbi Soloveitchik in which he talks about, it's an essay called Kol Dodi Dofek, and he talks about how God is knocking and we are supposed to respond to these knocks. He's right. This was from a lecture that he gave, if I remember correctly, in the late 50s or early 60s. And we were talking about the suffering that Jews experienced pre-state and how there was nowhere to run to and there were no options. And a Jew living in the Ukraine, you know, suffering under Khmelnytsky's massacres, or a Jew living at, you know, you pick the time and you pick the country in Europe, had nowhere to go and had no hope. And it's so hard to put ourselves into that mindset, living in the era that we have the fortune to live in. But that was Agnon's world. That, I mean, not by the time he writes this. I mean, there's no state when he writes this, but at least there's, you know, something growing in Israel. But the truth of the matter is, no, I'll go back and say, he lives in that world in the sense that even for the Jews in Israel at the time, living under the Ottomans, and then living under the British, they're living under hostile authorities, and they are suffering from attacks, and I think this is reality. I don't think he's prescribing it, I don't think he's choosing it. I think he's saying, this is what I see. That's my read. Claudette.
That's where I was going with this. I think there's a layer to this where Agnon, if you read the story, this man is not doing mitzvahs. He's not helping anybody. Right?
Right.
So Agnon is saying to us, the times are so bitter that the Jews are caught up with the bitterness and they're not focusing on being Jewish with the mitzvahs. And so they're focusing on surviving by serving the masters.
Right. Right. And that brings me actually to my next part. So thank you for the segue. A major theme here in the story, and we've noted it along the way, is Jewish assimilation in search of Christian support. Not assimilation per se. This fellow, this old man, is not assimilating, even though he is, as Claudette noted, not really practicing a lot of what we recognize as Jewish practice. But keep in mind that Agnon in the early 20s is living in Germany, a time with heavy assimilation by Jews. A period when there are Jews who are looking to Berlin as their new Jerusalem. And Agnon wrote stories about assimilation to Christianity. He has a story called The Lady and the Peddler, which is really remarkable, in which the one who's supposed to be the Christian, to whom the Jew appeals, turned out to be a vampire. Like, you can't be much more clear than that in your image. Take a look at source number 8. Professor Netta Stahl, writing about it, says, "The Lady and the Peddler is not a story about Yeshu, but rather a story about the Jewish self and what happens to it when it gives itself away for the sake of assimilating into the Christian world. Following the encounters with Yeshu, the Jew realizes his own foreignness. He also realizes the threat embodied in Christianity." And you see it very, very clearly in this story. The Jew literally trusts, quote, that man. How many times did we say that man in the story? He trusts that man with his money, and it is taken. The Jew expects the court to be just, and it is unjust, with a picture of a smiling Yeshu looking on. And yet at the end, and this I wanted to address the ending of the story and his flight to Israel, where he's, you know, it looks like he's being brought there by Yeshu, but then when he arrives in Israel, it's a group of angels. The Jew, despite the betrayal, still thinks that it's that man bringing him to Israel. It's not. Angels have come to bring him to Israel, and he thinks that it's the Christians who are doing it. You follow? The Jew doesn't understand the relationship with Christianity. He doesn't get it. He continues to credit them with his good fortune. You follow? That's what's going on at the end of the story. He's crediting them, incorrectly. So, That's another layer for Agnon, and it leads right into the Zionism of the story. Yes, Claudette.
I just wanted to make a note about the end of the story. At the end of the story, it says that the angel turned into stone, right? And I think Agnon is saying that what we end up serving was all these stones that they have in Europe, you know, all their statues, you know. So
it's like the statue that held the box.
Right.
Yeah, could be. Could be. Thank you. Rose.
So maybe it's only in the naivety, it's the desire, when you talk about the assimilation in the late 19th century and 20th century, the assimilation rate in Austria and Germany was unbelievably high. All the academics, the professors, all of those people. And it's that thing of, okay, I'm going to assimilate, I'm going to be that other person, right? And I credit Christianity will save me. But at the end of the day, it does not.
So I wouldn't be quite so harsh on the Jews who were there and say it's every professor and all of that.
I said a high percentage.
Again, I'm not a historian, and I'm not gonna, and I don't know. I do know that it was rampant. Beyond that, I wouldn't say. But it's true.
Just to give you a number, in Vienna, I think 10% of university professors were actually Jewish, mm-hmm. and 44% of the enrollment of the students were Jewish, and the conversion rate, and there was the non-Jews were very angry. After which the conversion rate became really high. I mean, I can't give you a figure on that one, but it was high.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I learned from a historian who taught me this.
Okay.
That's how I know it.
Okay. So that brings me to the Zionism layer, and there's so much to talk about in terms of the Zionism in this story. So the first message here is, and we've already mentioned this a little bit, don't rely on alliances with England. Take a look at source number 9, article on the British White Papers. The first official manifesto interpreting the Balfour Declaration. Okay, this is the White Paper. First of all, Balfour Declaration 1917 recognizes the Jewish right to a homeland in Israel. Right? That's our starting point. But then you get to the White Paper. So it's issued, as you see here, 1922, after the Haycraft Commission of Inquiry published its findings on the Arab riots of 1921. Although the White Paper stated that the Balfour Declaration could not be amended and that the Jews were in Palestine by right, it reduced the area of the mandate by excluding the area east of the Jordan River, which was given to the Emir Abdullah. This document also established the principle of economic absorptive capacity as a factor for determining the immigration quota of Jews to Palestine. It starts to limit the Balfour Declaration. And Agnon looks at that and he says, this, you can't rely on the British. He said that. If you take a look at source number 10, this is from Professor Abramson. She says, it, our story, was written as a response to the partition of mandatory Israel between the eastern side of the Jordan and western Israel. This response contained expression of disappointment in the promises of the nations given via the Balfour Declaration and then annulled. She said that that was what Agnon said. And in fact, I gave you a link in source number 11. This is a video by Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, who some of you are familiar with. He teaches at the Agnon House in Israel. And this video is called Agnon and the 100th Balfour Anniversary. And at the 16-minute mark of the video, he reads a letter from Agnon in which he said that this is where I am publishing my opinion on the Balfour Declaration. It comes across loud and clear in the story. Right? The Jew in this story is putting his money in a pushka, right? This was the era of the blue box, right? The JNF blue box that you're going to put your money in for supporting Israel and development of the land. But his blue box is stored with the Christians for protection. You think Balfour's going to take care of you. You're going to give him your blue box donations and then it's all going to come through. Remember again, I keep coming back to that story of Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, who gets labeled vinegar, son of wine, like the Jew does in this story, for making his alliance with the Romans, right? You are relying on the Romans. And he, in this story, is let down by the Christians he expected would help him save his money for Aliyah. He thought, I'm going to give them my money, and then I'll be able to take it out when I want and go to Israel. And he tries to take it out, and they say, no, this money is ours. And it fits so many biblical passages that warn against relying on the nations. Take a look at source number 12. I gave you a collection of just a few verses. One from the Book of Lamentations, in which Jeremiah says, our eyes are still finished, waiting for empty help. In our hopes, we anticipated a nation which does not save. We looked to the nations to help us, and boy, was that a mistake. A story from the Book of Kings 2, when there was a Jewish king named Menachem. King Pul of Assyria attacks the land. Menachem gave Pul 1,000 silver kikar to aid him to keep the kingdom in his hands. He bribes them to help, and of course that doesn't lead anywhere good. And then the last one, a verse in the prophet Hosea, Ephraim joins with the wind, pursuing the east wind all day. Ephraim is a reference to the northern tribes of Israel, the 10 tribes who are north of Jerusalem. They pursue the east wind, increasing lies and theft. They make a covenant with Assyria. Oil is brought to Egypt. They try to buy off the nations around them, and this is a criticism. Don't do it. Yes, Rosalind. Yeah, Rosalind, you were going to say?
So, my problem with his putting the money in the charity box is that he doesn't know he's putting it in a Christian charity box. There's a level of ignorance about this man. So, the way I see it in some way is that it's not just his problem with Christianity, the problem with Jews and Christians, but the whole conflict between traditional Jewish life and modern life. He's not functioning with knowledge of what's happening around him. And in some ways it's hard to blame the Christians for what he's doing, because he is putting his money in what is a sacred box to them. I mean, even though they seem to not be using it very much or taking good care, he's unaware of what he's doing, and his lack of knowledge is a problem, I think.
Right. So I think you're right. I think, I would make two comments. Number one, yes, Agnon is upset about the Jews who are blindly trusting the nations to help them and putting their stock in them, and their eyes are closed. They're not paying attention. They're not even aware of the extent to which they're doing this. And I think Agnon is sort of double dipping with this symbol, because on the one hand, he's using the man as a symbol of ignorance to be admired, a simple Jew who is respected for his simplicity, and on the other hand, he's mocking him, essentially, and saying, look at what the simple Jew does. He's double-dipping a little bit on that symbol. But the other thing I would note is that the blame with the Christians is not that the money was deposited. You're right. It's their box. The blame is that when this man is on trial, they're not even considering what he has to say. He's trying to get his words out and explain, and they're in a rush to convict him.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to say that Herzl went to Germany and to Russia and to the Ottoman Empire to find if he could get any help for a Jewish community in Israel. And only the British kind of answered him. What happened later is, and maybe in history will show, we were lucky to have the British there because they left. Perhaps other countries would have stayed in and, and put pressure on the Jewish community. So I think history is a little too early. And I personally don't like what Lamentations said about the Assyrians, because if you want to read it, in my eyes, a lot of what happened was because of the must follow the wrong, they put their support on the wrong power. They put it on Assyria when Egypt was strong, and they put it on vice versa. They played politics and the sub, and the result was...
But you can't blame... You can't blame the Jews for Assyria invading. You can say the Jews picked sides and they picked the wrong side. But you can't blame the victim of an invasion for the fact that the invader came. Assyria came through trying to gobble up as much as they could. The Jews agreed to become serfs, essentially, of the Assyrians. Then the Jews rebelled. Right? Thinking that Egypt was going to support them. But you can't, you have to start from the beginning of the story, which is the Assyrian invasion. And ultimately, from the perspective of Tanakh, this is really a story about the Jews and God. And the Assyrians and the Egyptians and everybody else are just pawns in the game. The Jews are supposed to be listening to the prophet who says, turn to God instead of trying to buy off the nations around you. So there's that piece of it as well. There's much more I want to say here, by the way. We're not even close to being done. So just frame, you know, make sure people are aware of that. Miriam and then Claudette.
I'll make it short. I grew up in Eastern Europe in the worst times, and there was always a Jewish community around. So you can always get either help or just communicate with someone and support was there. And on this story, there is no Jewish community at all.
Right.
Alone. I mean, nobody noticed that this man is killing himself.
Wait, there is a community, but not a helpful community. Meaning, you remember when he is arrested and suddenly everybody is talking about him and they say, oh, look at this, the desecration that this, you know, this Jew would do this. They judge him. He has no support from that community. And maybe that's another layer in this, is the absence of helpful community. Could be that that could be here as well. There are a whole bunch of layers we're not even going to touch. There's one writer on this story, a fellow by the name of Katzman, who talks about miscommunication as the theme or a theme in the story. There's a lot, but you're right. The absence of communal support, and especially when that was supposed to be such a hallmark of those Jewish communities, it's a very interesting point. Thank you for raising it. Claudette.
Agnon is writing this in before the Second World War.
Yes.
Right?
Early 20s.
And he is loudly saying, you know, how dangerous it is to be simple and put your hands in this, in the leadership of the world. What is, did he write anything after that on the Holocaust?
So he writes quite a bit after the Holocaust about the destruction of the Eastern European communities. He has a lot to say. He has a lot to say. And about Zionism. And that actually, thank you, you keep giving me segues. So that brings me to another theme within the Zionism of this story, which is that it is a polemic against anti-Zionists. And I have to credit Irv Matlow, who I saw here before. I lost your screen now. I hope you're here. When I taught this story for the Agnon group, no, I don't see him. Okay. Well, Irv sent me some ideas afterwards. Oh, there he is. You sent me some ideas, and I really liked them, about this story as a polemic against anti-Zionists. The Hasidim of the early 20th century were very strong against Jews leaving Eastern Europe. They did not want them to go to the New World, afraid that they would lose their religious identity there, which in fact happened with many people. They did not want them to go to Israel either. And within that group, there was a strong group that said that that you're not allowed to go to Israel. Take a look, please, at source number 13. There's a verse in Song of Songs. It actually shows up three times. I gave you one. I have made you swear, daughters of Jerusalem, lest you awaken and lest you arouse the love when you desire it. This is about the love between God and the Jews, which is supposed to lead the Jews back to the land of Israel, ultimately. But there's a warning here. it's not for you to initiate the relationship. Three times we are warned not to be the ones to, as it's put here, lest you arouse the love. Penta iru u penta oaru et ha ahava. So the Talmud asks, what does that mean? Why these three oaths? Take a look at source number 14. What is the purpose of these three oaths? Number one, that the Jews should not ascend as a wall. We should not try to conquer the land. Number two, that the Jews should not rebel against the nations. And number three, that the nations should not overly oppress the Jews. So there are verses, biblical verses, that support this idea that it's really God who is going to bring the Jews back. I brought you two examples, sources 15 and 16. Source number 15, God says, in the future, I will be, for them, a wall of fire surrounding them. I am going to be their protector. In source number 16 from Jeremiah, this is when the Jews go into exile. So says God, regarding the vessels that remain in the house of God and the house of the king of Judah and Jerusalem, they will be brought to Babylon. There they will remain until the day I remember them, says God, and I will bring them up and return them to this site. And the vessels are clearly a metaphor for the Jews. God is saying, you're in exile until I bring you back. So that there were Jews who said, we're not allowed to come back to the land. It isn't for us to go. And in fact, the three oaths can parallel some of the threes that you find in the story as well. Agnon is definitely aware of this, and he presents you the old man in the story who longs to go, and he prepares to go. But as Irv noted to me, he can't bear to leave, and he's waiting for an external sign, right? The breaking of this cistern, this can in which he is holding his vinegar. And ultimately, how does he get to the land? Not by his own agency. He's brought there by angels. One other note that Irv makes, the grape is one of the seven fruits that Israel is known for. This fellow lives a bitter experience in exile waiting for the Messiah to come. His wine becomes vinegar, right? Because he's waiting. So there's a layer here of criticism of those who are saying, I have to wait for God. You're waiting for God, you're waiting for God, you're waiting for God, and you're suffering in your exile. And ultimately, he only makes it back in death when he's brought there by the angels. So this is a message against the anti-Zionists in this. Parenthetically, there's a lot to be said about the three oaths that we read. I don't want to make this a whole discussion of that, especially as we only have 12 minutes left. But the third oath says that you are not allowed, that the nations are not allowed to overly oppress us. So as rabbis have written for centuries, they broke their oath. Therefore, our oath is no longer binding. If they don't keep theirs, then we are not obligated to keep ours. I mean, there are various justifications for going. I gave a class sometime back on Zionism and anti-Zionism, explaining the arguments back and forth. I think I did at Beth Tikva pre-COVID. If anybody's interested, I can send you the recordings. Let me know. One other Zionism layer here in the story is the idea that Zionism is a secular form of religion, which leads to Judaism. Not that love of Israel is secular. Love of Israel is religious, let's be clear. But the old man's initial coldness to ritual Judaism is what I'm on. We say he doesn't want the talis, he doesn't want the tefillin. He wants to be buried in Israel, right? We said that. That was explicitly his dream, was just to be buried in Israel. I call your attention to source number 7 from the Talmud. The sage Ula regularly traveled to Israel, but he died outside of Israel. They informed Rabbi Elazar, who said, you, Ula, will die on impure soil? He's quoting a verse from Prophet Amos. Rabbi Elazar was then informed that Ula's casket had arrived. He said, one who is absorbed while alive cannot be compared to one who is absorbed after death. Meaning someone who makes aliyah, someone who comes to Israel to live there, is infinitely better off than some, compared to somebody who only makes it there when their body is brought there. That isn't to say there's no value in burial in Israel. There is value in burial in Israel, but better to live in Israel. But that's not what this old man is doing. This man in the story says, I just want to be buried there. He doesn't even know what he would do if he was there. He's getting rid of his vinegar business. Like what would he actually do? And so we get elements that we've already noted in the story, so I'm going to go through them quickly. He splits his money, half for his needs and half to get to Israel, as opposed to the sage Hillel, who split his money, half for his needs and half for the study of Torah, like we talked about in the first week. He doesn't pray properly, but he says, if I get to Israel, I'll pray properly there. Sure. He fasts the Monday-Thursday fasts, but not religious Monday-Thursday fasts, fasts for the sake of getting to Israel. He dances at midnight instead of grieving for the temple at midnight, which is the classic. The whole business of dancing around the shoulders and not leaping to heaven like we talked about in a previous session. He licks the dirt, right? Did you notice him licking the dirt? Who in the Bible licks the dirt? Sorry? There's someone in the Bible who licks the dirt. The snake, right? The snake in the Garden of Eden is punished that he is going to have to eat dirt all the days of his life. It's a punishment for its inappropriate desire. The old man is initially cold to ritual Judaism. However, he is drawn to religion in the process. As we said, he takes that mystic's pose, which is a pose of repentance, like that story that we read about Elazar ben Dordaya putting his head between his knees. He finally rises at midnight in grief when he's in the jail. He turns his face to Jerusalem when he is being carried there. He does come around to this desire to come to Israel. I brought you two other passages. I'm sorry, I almost missed it. But in number 18, this is another passage about people who come to Israel to be buried. And it's actually a very harsh passage, in which the Jerusalem Talmud says, if somebody when someone sees, one of the sages sees caskets coming from outside of Israel, and he says, what good is this? They rejected my portion while alive, and they contaminate my land in their death. That's source number 18. But source number 19 is a source that testifies to what Agnon is saying here from Rav Kook. Remember that Agnon studied, he went to the classes of Rabbi Kook in Jaffa. So Rabbi Kook said the following, if at a certain time there should be found an arousal whereby people will speak only of the spirit of the nation and will attempt to negate the spirit of God, if people just talk about nationalism, we should have a state to be a nation, what should the righteous of the generation do? To rebel against the spirit of the nation, even verbally, and to reject its assets, this is something impossible. The spirit of the Lord and the spirit of Israel are one. Rather, the righteous must work hard to reveal the light and the holiness in the national spirit. You have to work with it. Find the holiness. And that's what Agnon is saying this old man actually finds. It just takes him a while to get there. I'm rushing a little bit because I wanted to get to the conclusion here. The conclusion of the story is the redemption of this old man in the story. We've seen so many different layers. We talked about the man as a Job last week. We talked about the story as being about injustice, and we've talked about the story as being about Jews appealing to Christians for support, and about relying on alliances with England and against the anti-Zionists. But the redemption of the old man, to me, is the most beautiful part of the story. Take a look, please, at source number 20, Midrash on Mishlei, that Agnon is channeling at the end of the story. Remember the end of the story? You know what? Take a fast look at the end of the story first. When the man goes to Israel, right after, at the end, it's like six lines up from the bottom at the end of the story. His heart melted, his hands waxed weak, he was set loose and fell to the ground. on the morrow when his captors came in, not to be found. Take a look now at source number 20. Rabbi Akiva was jailed by the Romans. His student, Rabbi Yoshua Hagarsi, served Rabbi Akiva when he was in jail. On the eve of Yom Tov, the holiday, he left him and went home. Elijah came to the entrance of his home. He said, "Greetings, my master." This is the student, Rabbi Yoshua. Elijah replied, "Greetings, my master and teacher." He asked, "Do you need something?" Elijah replied, "I am a Kohen. I have come to tell you Rabbi Akiva has died in the prison." How Rabbi Akiva died is a whole other story. That's what he says. Immediately, both of them went to the prison and found the prison entrance open and the warden sleeping and all the prisoners sleeping. They lay Rabbi Akiva on a bed and left. They carried Rabbi Akiva out. So the old man disappears from the jail as Rabbi Akiva disappears from his jail. But more than that, go back to the end of the story in the English there. That night a knocking was heard on the door of the Kollel in Jerusalem. Those who went outdoors saw a flight of angels which had come from the exile bearing a mortal form, which that very night they took and buried. Take a look at source number 21 from the Talmud. When a righteous person passes away, three groups of ministering angels, malachim, go out to greet him. So he has the fate of the righteous. He is escorted by the angels. And finally, unclear to me where he is buried. Look at the last lines of the story. That very night they took and buried him in keeping with the custom in Jerusalem not to hold over the dead. They didn't leave bodies overnight. He's quoting source number 22, a Tosefta, a source from the time of the Mishnah 2,000 years ago, which says, we do not leave a corpse, we do not leave human bones there in Jerusalem. They would not leave them. And we do not establish graves. We're not allowed to bury in the old city in Jerusalem to start a new cemetery. Other than the graves of the house of David and of Huldah the prophetess, who were there since the times of the early prophets. So I'm not clear in this story whether Agnon is saying that they actually end up burying him in Jerusalem or whether he's just saying they don't want to leave the body and they go take him outside of Jerusalem to bury him. But I wonder if he isn't saying no, he's buried in Jerusalem. He gets this honor like members of the house of David and Huldah the prophetess. That I'm not sure about. But certainly the first two points, the disappearance from the jail like Rabbi Akiva, and being escorted to Israel by angels, that's very much there. The old man who has suffered so much in the story, and yes, Susan, the suffering is not something that we could ever feel good about because of the ending. Nonetheless, he finds his redemption here, even as he still thinks it's the Christians bringing him there. He still thinks the statue is taking him to Israel. Nonetheless, God has taken him in, so to speak. So that's the story. We could go on with layer upon layer. There's a lot more that could be said. But I hope now those who have not been exposed to Agnon before have a sense of who this writer is. And yeah, there is a lot in English. As I noted in the translation here, there are things here I don't like in the translation. I think they missed some things. But it's better than nothing. So if you can hack the Hebrew, take the Hebrew. But if you can't, then go with the English. There's a lot to read. Hopefully those who know Agnon still got something out of this read of the story. And again, as I said in the beginning, June 15th, June 22nd, a two-parter on when will the Messiah come. I'm hoping that many of you will be there in person, not just when the Messiah comes, but that many of you will be there in person when we have this class, June 15th and June 22nd. I understand those who are staying on Zoom. But if you can come learn in person, it's such a different experience. Remember what it was like? I hope to see you there. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you,
Rabbi.
Thank you very much.